Session number 31407, Reel 3.
Did you share your gripes with, you know, the fact that you felt you'd all been sidelined? Was there anyone you could, you know, convey this to, or you were just there, you had to keep your head down and just get on with it? And
No, we just did our job. I think at that time, you know, I thought, roll on my demob.
Because we were now coming through 43, it was obvious that the tide had changed. I mean, yep. The Americans were pouring into the country and something was going to happen. So what happens next then?
Well, eventually I was sent to Inskipt.
To 768 Squadron.
Yeah. Where, again, with Swordfish, we were then introduced to rockets and to depth charge bombing. And we did patrols out into the North Sea exercises, the Irish Sea, not North Sea, Irish Sea. And we did a lot of night flying, a lot of formation flying, and fired our rockets on the ranges, and also did our jet charge runs.
Can you talk a little bit about how you were trained to fire rockets and drop the depth charges? What was the process of training you in this?
We were just told how to do it, and we went and did it.
And were the rockets effective and accurate?
Yes, they were armor-piercing. They were deadly. And the Wrens in the observations would mark wherever they fell. We had an actual record. But we had I can't remember, an angle of dive which you had to do, and then we had a gun sight on when you lined up.
And at what range would you let them off? Can you remember?
I can't remember offhand.
And for depth charges, the process of that, the depth charges?
We had a Mickey Mouse, what they call a Mickey Mouse, which was a black box down the side where you could select the bombs and or the rockets, whichever you were carrying. And you could fire the lot, or you could fire them individually. So you had to select these, and of course, whether it was depth charges. Depth charges we normally dropped in a pattern. So we dropped two on one side and two on the other.
And formation... And formation flying, that was something that you hadn't done before, I assume?
No, I hadn't done any formation flying before then, no.
And how was that? Again, you were just told how to do it and you did it.
Well, just got into it. The worst was the night firing of rockets. Where someone had devised a rocket flare. And the idea was that if you got a contact, you flew towards the contact at a certain range, you pulled up into a very steep climb and fired off two flare rockets, which would go up and drop over the sub if you got your distances right, which you would have with the radar, which we had. Then you'd then push the nose forward, go in and dive. And the theory was, and of course I think it did actually work when they tried it artificially, everyone looked where the flares came, thinking the attack was coming from that side. And of course it came from the other side, and at night was more difficult to see. It was quite a cunning idea. But it was quite hair-raising because when you pulled up into this very steep line and you fired the rockets at the right time, you tended to watch the two taillights of each rockets, and you could quite easily stall at that stage. In fact, we did lose one aircraft one night.
Sorry, let me just... I think it came from here. Come on, go away, Doug.
Yeah. Janet.
Would you like some coffee?
Love some, yes, that would be good. Thank you. So, just do you want some coffee?
Yes.
I'll put it in the kitchen, and it's an absolute nuisance, and it's all... That man.
No, it's not my fault.
Of course.
Had to be mine.
So you lost an aircraft, went into a store.
We don't know. It just disappeared. It was a terrible night. I can remember it now. It was hazy, we're over the water, there was no horizon, and it was so easy. In those days, we had no autopilots or anything, and you'd get disorientated. And you had to trust your instruments, and certain people didn't, and they'd lose it. And anyway, we sent a search party out the next day, and all we found was one floating wheel. Nothing else, nothing ever was recovered. So Petty Officer Diggins was the pilot, who had his observer was an ex-London policeman who got in out of the police force only because he went into flying, which was the regulation. And I can remember him saying sometime before, actually, that this Petty Officer Diggins was going to kill him. And we said, well, you know, well, why don't you do something about it? But he didn't. It was a great shame, actually. But
so you were conscious of the fact that there were pilots who were not really up to scratch, even though they were. I mean, so that was also a part of the story.
That's why I didn't like flying.
Well, especially in formation flying, I imagine you have to trust people, and you have to.
Well, you have to trust everybody. Yeah, and very difficult in those days too. I mean, with modern jets, I mean, it's quite easy because you get the response and that. But in those days, of course. Engine power was limited, taking the swordfish.
Everyone I've spoken to this speaks very highly of the swordfish and says, well,
oh, it's a beautiful aircraft, yes, reliable, easy to fly, didn't have any bad habits, and you could get away with murder in it. But you still had to fly.
You have to come back. Shall we stop?
I'm just going to get you somewhere.
Okay. Right. Okay. So, yeah, we're at Inskip.
That's it. Yeah.
You've just lost a pilot through stalling, and you're training in night and rocket flying. And the qualities of the swordfish, it was a very benign plane.
Yeah.
In terms of instruments that you actually had, I'm sure the people at the War Museum will know this, but the instrument panel, you had artificial horizons. What was the instrumentation like? Pretty simple?
Well, it was simple, yes. We had an artificial horizon, a turn and bank, altimeter, and an airspeed indicator. That was it. Plus, of course, the engine instruments of engine oil, temperatures, pressures.
And the engine was reliable. What kind of engine did they
have? Well, they were Pegasus engines, Bristol Pegasus. A very reliable engine. I've read in books of the swordfish, having come under fire and having flown back on a couple of cylinders missing, and it was still going. No, it was quite a remarkable aircraft all the way around. Well, it must have been to have survived the time it did, from the early 30s right through to the end of the war, because we were still flying them in May 1945.
So anything other at Inskip? You've trained then in the firing of rockets, the use of depth charges.
Mm-hmm. And then we also, whilst we were there, the other major thing, of course, was ADLs, aerodrome dummy deck landings, and NADLs, night aerodrome dummy deck landings.
Tell me about those. How were you trained for NADLs, for example?
Well, we're just, again, told what to do. There was no duel.
So you went up with your... Did you have your crew with you, or did you go up?
No, we went up, took our crew with us, yes.
Could we just talk about sort of a typical NADL?
Well, one just took off and then flew around at the normal sort of carrier height, which is about 150 feet, and then approached on a turn towards the end of the runway, and would pick up the signals from the batsman, and there was a landing speed or approach speed which you got onto the clock, and then you followed the batsman's signals down.
And the batsman, because it was night, would have what beacons?
Well, he had two wands, electric wands, a little light and a little cup, and one on his chest. So he got the position up and down from the relative position of the chest. And we used what was called DREM lighting, which was a very dim lighting, which was only visible at a certain angle of approach.
And was it a quite easy, or was it fairly nerve-wracking to do?
Well, I suppose it was to start with, actually. I did think that when it came, because later on we went to HMS Argus to actually carry out proper deck landings, and I do remember feeling a bit nervous at the thought of doing night deck landings. But having done them by day and then doing them by night, I almost found them easier by night than day, because, as I've said since, at night you couldn't see the drop side, either side of the ship, which you could see by day, and you were coming in onto two lights which looked really just like a truncated airfield runway. So they weren't as difficult and as frightening. But that's in calm weather.
We'll come to that later.
When it's rough, then it gets very different.
So you train in this the two sorts of landings at Inskip, and you fly on to.
We then took our aircraft and landed on the deck of HMS Argus.
And how long did you spend doing that? So just
I wish I had my logbook.
Actually, John Shoebridge had his. He did. I think it was only five deck.
Yes, we didn't. Yes, we didn't do a lot.
And you didn't actually stay on Argus. This was
It was just a day and a night. I think we did a night deck landing, so we must have stayed on there at night, and then flown off the next day. But there was very few landings, practice landings.
Did you know about MAC ships by this time?
No.
So you had no idea again what this could be leading to.
We didn't even know where we were going. And at the end of the course, when we'd passed out, we all went our separate ways.
This is early 1944.
44. I think some went to escort carriers. I found myself appointed to 836. So once again, aboard the inevitable. Puff, puff, and went to Larn, across from Larn to, which is it, Stranraer Larn. I forget which way it goes now.
My geography's terrible.
And then across on the next train from in the island across to Maidan, which is just outside Londonderry. And then I joined the squadron there. In fact, I think it went to. I think there was a training squadron, if I remember rightly. When I was on, I can't remember. I spent some time there anyway, and it might have been from there we were sent to various other squadrons. I was sent to 836 anyway. And during that time, I was due to be promoted a chief penny officer. And I wouldn't put in an application. So once more, I was sent for the commander. Who said, why won't you put in to be a chief petty officer? And I said, well, I don't want to be a chief petty officer. Why not? I said, well, I joined up under the impression that I was going to get a commission. I said, and unless I get a commission, my ambition is to get out of the Navy. But if I get a commission, it'd be different. Oh, I see. So I went on my way. Next day, there was a signal from the Admiralty commissioning me.
Well done. So that worked. So you
it worked.
Called their bluff anyway. Yeah. So otherwise you might have been signed.
I could have been, yeah. So I was then commissioned.
Interesting. I suppose also in the nature of the MAC ship, because the messes were so small, if you'd been a petty officer, it would have complicated things, I imagine. Were there any other petty officer pilots?
I don't know, because the squadron was so big and we never knew each other. I mean, we had 26 flights, and some would be at Maidan, some would be on MAC ships going out, some would be on MAC ships coming home, others would be at in Halifax, at HMCS, Dartmouth, so near the train shore meters, they say.
So you join your flight, you do a little bit of training on Maidan.
I was trained at, joined 836. And eventually said, well, tomorrow you'll go aboard. They MV MacAndrew. So we packed our bags and off we went. And
you flew on board?
We flew on board in the Clyde.
And landing for the first, was this the first landing on a Mac ship?
Mm-hmm.
And how was that? Because it was considerably smaller than anything else you would have landed on, I imagine.
Yeah. I can't remember. It must have been all right because I'm still here.
And then you've got this. I mean, it's such a strange world, isn't it? The Mac ship pilots, the flights, because they, you know, two flights a day, trundling across backwards and forwards across the Atlantic. How did it? What was it like joining that sort of quite small world of four pilots on a ship?
It was rather nice, really, because we literally were on our own, and although the captain was captain. And he still had authority over us. He didn't interfere with us at all. And life aboard was very pleasant. We had a cabin. We shared a cabin. I shared a cabin with my observer, Nicky Minden, and Peter Pace, my gunner. He, of course, he was a petty officer, but he was down below on the petty officer deck. And we had the... what do they call it? I think they called it the lounge or the smoke room, I think it was.
Smoke room, I think.
Yeah. And we had a dining hall, and life was very pleasant. We had a bar. We could get drink, and we also, unlike naval ships, we could go down to the store and buy a bottle. It was quite amusing thinking. I think whiskey was 3 and 6 a bottle, duty-free. Gin half a gram. And when I think of the amount that was on board ships that got sunk and the amount that's lying in the bottom of the Atlantic.
And you flew roughly once or twice a day, didn't you? There was a dawn patrol and an evening patrol.
Well,
I suppose it varied.
It varied in so much that we might send one off or two aircraft. It just depended what the situation was. If the situation was bad, then of course there was a scare on anywhere, they'd been contacts, and you might fly day patrol. But it was mainly evening and sunset. When?
Why was that? Because that was...
I think that was at the time that they realised was most of the attacks took place under virtually the cover of darkness. And again at night, although I personally never went, I went off in the dark, but I mean it was a dawn patrol. But we never, and I can never remember actually taking off in the middle of the night, say at midnight and flying till 2 or something. I can't remember doing that.
Were you on a grain ship or an oil ship? I mean, in other words, was there an elevator or
we were on grain ships. The MacAndrew and the MacDermott, I was on, but they were both grain ships.
So the Swordfish was stored below?
They were stored below in the hangar, which was a great asset. Because those on the tankers, I mean, how those lads serviced the aircraft, I don't know. We had a special propeller fitted because the decks were so short. It was a very fine pitch propeller, which was not variable, so we had it all the time, and that of course cut down our cruising speeds. We had a very slow cruising speed, but which was a disadvantage if there's a high winds and you got behind the carrier, because catching up would be quite difficult at times, as some unfortunate pilots found out.
I think there was one lost, wasn't there? I
think more than one actually lost.
What was the major hazard then? It was running out of fuel, of not finding your way back?
Well, we had radar, and we always found our way back, but the trouble was if you were sent off behind the convoy, I mean, normally it was ahead, but if you were sent behind and there was a high wind, or if, and very often happened, the convoy altered course as planned, and you hadn't got the information past you, and then you might have a difficult, but as I say, with the radar, but we got Mark Mark 10, I think it was, but X-ray. We called it X-ray. It was Mark 10. Radar towards the end of the war. And that was much better. That was the one with the big dome under the nose of the aircraft. Whereas the original ones were little prongs of wire sticking out on the wingtips.
And the observer would be...
He monitored that, yeah. Mm.
And he'd speak to you through the speaking... The famous speaking tubes.
Yeah. Mm.
Landing on and off in very rough weather, was that a skill that you... Well, you learnt, you had to learn, I suppose. Was it?
You learnt the hard way again.
And what were the techniques that you...
Well, the main technique was to trust the batsman, because he could really see what the deck was doing. Because the approach, the ship was so small, you couldn't really see the deck. I mean, you literally could only see the batsman and right up the port side of the ship. So you really had to, and if he gave you a wave off, you went around. But he would try and judge it to give you the cut, just as it was coming up, rather than going down. To get you on.
The cut, this was the American system that was introduced, wasn't it? The cut? Well, this is when
no, we had the cut anyway.
Well, can you talk about it? Sorry, I'm not quite familiar what the cut is. Can you tell me what that is?
Well, when the batsman gave you the cut, you cut your throttle, cut the engine, and you stalled onto the deck. In the modern aircraft, of course, you fly on. I mean, you do a three-point landing. But all our landings were a stalled landing. You actually got the aircraft into a position where when you cut the throttle at a low speed, you actually stalled it and sank and hit the deck. That was a technique in its own, really.
And, I mean, there must have been times when that was slightly wrong. I mean, the undercarriage must have been fairly substantial.
Well,
to take...
they were good undercarriages, yeah. But, yes, occasionally undercarriages were broken.
And there was a barrier?
We had a barrier, yeah.
Did you ever hit that? Did you ever have any hairy landings?
No. Nope. I was very fortunate. I wouldn't say they were not hairy, but I do remember once taking off. I don't know, the aircraft must have been looking back, left out in the open for a long time, and I think it got a lot of rust or something on the cylinders, because I took off and I was showered in sparks from the engine. And I didn't know what, and I asked for an emergency landing, and I landed back on. I kept coming straight round and came back on, actually. That, well, it wasn't, I suppose, in a way it was a bit hairy, but I think it was more fearing what was happening to the engine than...
But, I mean, John Shoebridge told me that there's one incident where you had an escort carrier as part of the convoy, and it was too rough for them to fly off. But you were on the same ship as John, were you? Some of the time.
I think that was when he was on the McMahon. I don't remember that actually happening. I don't remember any convoys that I was on where we had an escort with us. But it could, because John joined it before I did, and he was on the McMahon. So I think that was probably on the McMahon, actually.
And I mean, there must have been times when you couldn't fly off because the weather was too bad.
Oh, I can remember one crossing we did when we didn't fly at all. The weather was so bad. That was sometime during the winter of 44, when the weather was tremendous. I mean, we had lifelines rigged up everywhere on the ship, just to get about on any open well decks or anything. It was an exceptionally bad crossing, that one. But we flew on and we flew off, but I can't remember. We may have flown once or twice, but most of the time we didn't fly at all.
So what did you do then when we were passengers, or when there was downtime, when you weren't flying, what would you do?
Well, there was nothing much to do, actually. We did get a Met report through, which we decoded and plotted out and roughly forecasted as best we could, having done Met, what the weather conditions would be, and passed it to the captain, who then passed it on, I think, to the rest of the convoy. But other than that, we'd play bridge, we'd play darts, and We used to put on little shows and stuff, and we rehearse for those.
And how did you get on with the merchant crew, the merchant navy crew?
Oh, they were fine, actually. Yeah.
You had a friendly relationship, wasn't
there? A very friendly. No. I used to stand watch with the first mate, actually, up on the deck when I wasn't flying. That was another way passing time. Yes, it was.
And were there any submarine attacks on convoys that you were on?
Well, again, I can't remember any specific. I never was called out on a specific one. We did our patrols, but it was towards the end of the war. But they do say, I mean, that it was the presence of the aircraft which was keeping them down. I know we didn't lose any ships when the convoys I were on. The only ship I saw sunk was one off of Berry Head before I joined up. It was a tanker, because Brixham was an oil depot, and that was bombed, and that went up in flames, and it was a tremendous sight, but that's the only ship that I've actually seen sunk.
And when you were on patrol, there was the Cobra and the Mamba patrols, weren't there?
There were all these.
Could you talk about those a little bit?
To be quite honest, I cannot remember.
Okay,
I know we had all these various code names for the patrols we were to do. Some were ahead of the convoy, some were behind the convoy, and no, I can't. I could only refer to my book, which that one, and they're all in there actually.
Is there any patrol that sticks out in your mind, or any convoy, particular convoy that you? I don't know how many you did in that period, but.
The only thing occasion that I do remember was we were out on patrol, and I thought we'd seen a snorkel. And I did arm all my rockets up. We were then fitted with the rockets, because at the end of the war we only had the rockets. The beginning of earlier we had the depth charges, but we had rockets. And we went down to, well, I went down to attack, because I did think it was a sub, and when we got down, we suddenly realised it was a whale. It was the fins sticking up out the water. So we pulled away and flew off and went back on our patrol. And then my observer said, "Stand by to find a wind." Well, to find a wind, we used to drop a smoke float and do a set pattern around it, and then he would work out from that the drift and what have you. And then eventually the wind. So we were flying along, and he said, "Stand by to drop a smoke float." So I made the switch for the which held the little smoke bombs. And then he said, "Fire," but I didn't realise at the time, of course, that I hadn't disengaged all the rockets. So not only did I drop a smoke float, but I fired off 8 rockets in the air. Not at the right speed. And the aircraft almost stopped. And once again, I was in trouble, wasting rockets, and had to account for them when I got there. The other interesting thing, again, it was in late 44, we eventually got, it was when we got the Mark III aircraft with the new radar. They took off the fine pitch and gave us back the original pitch propeller, but they fitted the aircraft with RATOG, which was rocket-assisted takeoff. And these we fired, but it was worked out on a graph with the wind speed and the ship speed to a certain point on the deck, and someone used to stand there with a little red flag and wave it as we passed. And at that point we pushed the button and hoped that both rockets would go off at the same time, actually, which occasionally they did misfire, but normally they weren't, actually, which shot us into the air.
And it was a fairly reliable system. You really felt these things?
Oh, yes, obviously. They worked. When they worked well, yeah.
And once
but I'd say occasionally you'd have one that misfire or didn't fire.
And what would happen then? You'd limp off the...
You would limp off the end and probably swing violently.
And would you ditch the empty rocket shells?
Yeah, we just ditched those and got rid of them, yeah.
Right.
we were actually, the end of the war, we were actually